all know that the best way to reach out to troubled inner-city youth and educate them is to challenge the toughest one to a knife fight and win. But did you know that the secret to the best cup of coffee you'll ever make is to start with freshly roasted beans? Unfortunately, most coffee you find at the grocery store or the staff lounge was roasted months before it got to you. But that's okay, because now there's Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans that are directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer lots of blends and roasts to choose from, including decaf and half-calf. But best of all, Sparkplug always delivers this coffee right to your door within a week of being custom-roasted right here in Toronto. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Settle down, class, and welcome to our weekly podcast that jaws about movies, usually of the classic variety. We have our roots in the American Film Institute's Top 100 lists, but now we review whatever we want. And hear me now that we spoil motion pictures like jerks, because we're big jerks. I am your movie teacher, Mr. Ellis, and seated to my right is your other movie teacher, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
So, the coming attraction is trivia for this week's picture, Blackboard Jungle. Name three other major film and TV products that featured the song Rock Around the Clock.
Okay, well, the first one's super easy. It's the movie Rock Around the Clock.
Released in 1956, the year after this one came out.
Because the song became such a big hit after the movie came out, so they capitalized on that. It was also in American Graffiti, that iconic soundtrack. And for the first two seasons of Happy Days, it was the theme song before they wrote Happy Days.
People may have forgotten that one because they want to think that these days are ours, share them with me, oh happy days. Was the theme all along, but it wasn't.
And surely it was in lots of movies over the years.
That's why I said major, because if it's just in some movie for the sake of a 5-second scene, it doesn't really count. There may be more than three, I don't even know, but those three are the ones I found, and so did you.
It's a truly iconic song for good reason.
All right, the next 100 Project's 13th movie, Blackboard Jungle, was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists, but of course did not make it. The flick was released by MGM in March of 1955. It made much money. But Bev, not many people are probably going to be familiar with this film. I'd forgotten a lot about it when I saw it a few days ago with you. Explain it to them in the skinny.
Glenn Ford is Rick Dattier, an English teacher new to the inner city who's faced with a class of tough teens. A young Sidney Poitier is Miller, and Vic Morrow is West, two of the leaders of the bad boy students. And Anne Francis is Dattier's pregnant wife, Anne.
Or, in a nutshell, smashing the back of a student's head in the blackboard should be part of the curriculum.
It worked.
For him it did, inspiring other students too. Okay, a few numbers before we get going into the conversation. For Rotten Tomatoes critics, 76% of them liked Blackboard Jungle, 16 fresh, 5 rotten, and 77% of audiences. It was ninth at the 1955 U.S. box office. Rebel Without a Cause, the only film we did on the Top 100 Project from this year, was not on the top 10 of that year. It was also controversial with the ratings boards because of the subject matter. They said the word hell, the racial slurs. The poster also said, the most startling picture in years! But Bev, were you startled by Blackboard Jungle?
If this was the most startling picture in years, then I don't know what that says about the state of pictures in 1955. And no, I didn't like it. I haven't said this in a while about a film that we've covered, but okay, it's hard to watch it without seeing it through the lens of cultural relativism. And the view from 2016 of this film was pretty bleak. Regardless, I don't think it's that good. The pacing is weird. The character of Dattier is really inconsistent. Mm-hmm. The violence is a telenovela level of exaggeration. It's condescending to the audience as it is to the students it is purporting to depict. And I would say that the only really redeeming thing about it is Poitier's performance.
Oh, the supporting character who was not that new to movies. He'd been in the business for about 5 years, Sidney Poitier, that is. He started in No Way Out in 1950 with Richard Widmark.
Is the 1980s version a remake?
Different plot.
Okay.
Same title. Poitier and Vic Morrow were cast as young students, yet they're both in their mid-20s by the time they made this movie. That's not that uncommon for any film that's ever been made, that you have 20-year-olds, or sometimes even 30-year-olds playing teenagers. I agree with you that Poitier is the best thing in the movie from an acting standpoint. What surprise is that, though, because the guy became one of the great actors of all time. A few years after this, he's working with Tony Curtis in The Defiant Ones. We probably should see that. That one is so on the nose with its racial themes, but it's very effective.
You know, so was Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and I still enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. But I want to focus on a movie that we did cover for the Top 100 Project. We haven't focused that much on those movies in our next 100 movies so far. But the same year, Rebel Without a Cause came out, the autumn of 1955, so only a few months after this one. They both cover troubled teens who get a little murderous. Switchblades come out in both movies. The difference is that Daddier is a real influence on their lives, and the teachers in Rebel Without a Cause, not so much.
Yeah, they're incidental. Rebel Without a Cause, I'd say the most significant difference is that it's all told strictly from the perspective of the kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's them, and they're just as messed up, and they're just as prone to bad decision-making, but it's truly their lives seen through their eyes, whereas Blackboard Jungle, it's strictly Daddier. He's the protagonist of the film, and we only see the kids through his lens of whether or not he's going to be able to control them and get through to them.
But one more thing I want to say about the two films is that we've got the inner city here with Blackboard Jungle, but Rebel, despite all the problems these kids have, and hey, any kid in that time of their life has every right to feel messed up, even if you are rich. But the kids in Rebel are doing okay financially.
Yeah, they're middle class kids. That's
and
a big
these
difference.
Kids in Blackboard Jungle are not.
No.
They're the ones who are going to get left behind by society as technology and everything moves on, the economy just steamrolls people like this right into the dustbin of history because they don't count.
Okay, but Miller, it's pretty explicit that he has a job lined up out of high school, and it certainly wouldn't be a tragedy for him to become a mechanic like he wants to. He seems to be good at it, and to just do that for a living and have a decent life. It's just that Daddier sees that he's smart enough and he's good enough, he's talented enough that he could go away further. Although, I don't know how realistic that would be in 1955.
He's got a lot of musical taste as well.
Yeah, he's musically talented as well. And he would have lots of potential had he been a white kid born in suburbia in the 50s, like James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause. That's absolutely true. I don't think it's a bad life, necessarily, that he would have. It's just some wasted potential.
It's a nice touch, too, that the black guy, or guys, his friends, end up being heroic. They have their choir. They seem like pretty good guys beyond all the tough posturing they put on early on. He ends up being a friend to Daddier. They're in the last scene together.
He's the student that Daddier gets through to that he rescues.
I think the movie's suggesting that he gets through to a lot more than just him, though.
Sure, sure. But it's through Miller that he gets through to all the rest of the kids. Because as he says near the beginning of the film, he's a leader. And it's smart of the film, even in the 50s, I suppose, it's smart of the film to make the real villain a white kid.
Unusual, though, too.
Maybe that's why it stood out.
It's been shorthand forever in Hollywood, even up till now, to have people who don't look like you and I to be the bad guys.
Okay, but in a film like this, it's a white hero movie, right? It's a white savior movie. There's no doubt about that. Like Lawrence of Arabia, like Dances with Wolves, a lot of education movies that have been made since then. A great example that everyone knows is Dangerous Minds, where you have the plight of minorities as seen through a white character that saves them from their circumstances. So it's a hallmark of the white savior movie to at least acknowledge it's their circumstances that hold them down and not themselves, their very nature. It just wouldn't be a politically popular thing to do to make the bad guy anybody who wasn't white. The rapist near the beginning of the film who corners the female teacher is white. And Vic Morrow plays West, who's absolutely the bad guy who finally threatens Daddier with a knife and also breaks all of the records of the other teacher. Mm-hmm. Total sociopath. He's a little exaggerated, a lot exaggerated.
He's worse than a bully.
Yeah.
He belongs in jail.
What makes him come to school? This is one of the things I found funny about this movie is they're such bad kids. From beginning to the very end, they give every teacher such a hard time. They don't have any respect for the rules, and yet they still show up to class every day.
Wes is always in class. He also works overtime to fuck with Daddier rather than just do his schoolwork.
I know.
He has a second job. I don't know if he has any kind of actual job. Probably doesn't. But his main job, then, is just to mess with this teacher.
He's so sadistic. It's one of the details in the film that's kind of over the top. Not just how awful he is, what a bad villain he is, but the letters he sends to Daddier's wife insinuating that Daddier is cheating on her while she's pregnant traumatize her so much that she goes into early labor, as if that's a thing, as if stress make women spontaneously go into labor. It's just because they were worried we weren't going to consider him enough of a villain without a baby's life being at stake as well.
Breaking those records convinced me, man. That was just a bullying tactic.
As soon as that teacher
says... too far!
As soon as the teacher says he's going to bring in records, I'm like, why?
You did say it.
It was so predictable.
And this was the first time you ever seen this movie, so you didn't predict that because you knew it was coming. You were new to the whole film.
Just because the whole film is one scene after another of people giving these kids an opportunity to do something awful, and then the kids doing something awful, and then they react to it.
That's why this movie is the most controversial film in years, according to the poster. Not many movies, and of course Rebel Without a Cause later the same year, did some of the same kinds of things, but this one's more explicit in a way, I suppose. Showing the students in the glorious 50s that all the politicians since Reagan up till about now in America will jack off to constantly. We gotta go back to the 50s, man. Back to the old days when things were good. And yet there are so many things wrong with America and the world, as there always are. What is the ultimate great era in the history of the world or the history of America? There isn't one. Mm-hmm. And there's so many examples of what's wrong with the 50s. We'll talk about a few of them in a second here. But this notion that kids, students, are fucked up in the 50s. They have problems. They cause problems. What? I don't think people really had thought about that until movies like Blackboard Jungle. And that's probably why it was nominated for the AFI's list, because as dated as it is, and this movie is very dated, we've already talked about some of the reasons why, we'll get to a few more of them in a minute here, it did have that element of breaking this news. Sometimes movies, as much as any news report, show people what's really going on. Is it a documentary? No. But it shows a fictional element of something that was actually true. I don't doubt for a second this was true. Probably all along, actually, the 40s, the 30s, 1812. People were always messed up. Here's what I want to talk about when you talk about the glorious 50s. There's so many things that are just so screwed up. We just said a minute ago, the kids were always assholes.
Yeah.
There you go, bitter old man. I want to go back to the days before the kids had the right attitude and weren't just navel-gazing on Facebook. Kids were always assholes. And again, this movie isn't a documentary, but it shows that fact right there. The pregnant mother, Anne, casually drinking booze. Oh, the 50s. And you could do things like that and get away with it.
I got the job. Let's drink champagne. She's 4 months
pregnant. And she knows she's pregnant. This isn't one of those things we find out later on. And also, Anne loves to blame women for being attacked because they're sexy. Oh, those 50s. The time we got to go back to.
Oh, yeah. And then when the rapist is thwarted, all of the students turn against Daddy A because the rapist got in trouble. I can't believe you did him like that. The 50s, I mean, we're talking about the racial sensitivities in the film. There was a Jim Crow in the South. I know this takes place in New York, right?
Well, this is inner city. I don't think it really matters if it's New York. Let's assume it is, because okay, movies were off like in New York or L.A. back in this time.
It doesn't
frame.
Seem like the South anyway. In the South, there was still Jim Crow. This was pre-civil rights era, or like really on the cusp of it. But the movie-going public that they were making this film for is definitely pre-civil rights. The 50s were a great time and place for a very small and specific group of people.
Including people like Daddier, mm-hmm. Daddy-O. If all teachers were as cynical as Daddier's co-workers, and then often him, and you pointed this out, he does flip-flop a lot, then kids are just fucked. Because as bad as I'm sure that these kids have been, the Louis Calhern character, this really cynical teacher... I don't blame him, I guess. I'm not in his shoes. He's a fictional character, but I can believe that people like this actually have these kinds of attitudes. You probably should have a little bit more belief in the next crop of students coming in there. Maybe it's like this almost stupid, blind, the next group would be perfect. Okay, then the next group. The next group. And I cannot relate to this, obviously, but I'm just saying that if a teacher gets this angry at their students before they've even done anything wrong in the new school year, then how are the kids going to ever succeed?
If I may, he is a bit of a broken record, because every time he's in a scene, it's just to point out over and over and over again that they're animals, that they're undisciplined, that there's nothing you can do, that they're hopeless. And the point you make about the next class is a good point, because, okay, Daddy A has succeeded over the course of an entire semester in getting through to this one class, but the school year is going to change, and the next year he's going to have a brand new group of unruly kids he's going to have to get through to.
Although maybe his new tactic of banging heads on blackboards will become the thing he does.
How does he get away with that? Teachers would never in this day and age. That would be it. That would be the end of his career. He would probably get arrested.
He does have witnesses. The kids would be able to tell authorities Wes came after him with a switchblade, and he didn't have a weapon in response. In fact, he got cut with a switchblade, so he's got blood in his hands. No one else does, so you could argue that he's the victim entirely in this, in self-defense, but still, when you disarm him of that switchblade, you probably shouldn't keep on banging his head against the blackboard.
And it is the sign of the times that that is the climax of the film, and that him beating West in a fight is what wins the students' respect. This film was made today. Never in a million years would they let him touch a student in under any circumstances. Even if he did attack him, they would never let the film conclude like this. A teacher solving a problem with violence is a very 50s thing.
He'd probably be gone from the school, too. The writer of the book that this is based on, Evan Hunter, who later wrote The Birds for Hitchcock and plenty of other films. He mostly wrote books, actually, but he wrote some screenplays. He was a school teacher in the South Bronx, so it is based on his own experiences.
Mm-hmm. It was probably drawing attention to something that people either weren't aware of at all or just turned a blind eye to. And this was the first generation of kids in a while in the United States. They were unique in that there was no war, there was no depression. They were probably somewhat aimless or just didn't have any real problems
much
to distract.
Much like the 90s, when we didn't have any real wars. There were a few, granted, but nothing major. And of course, we're Canadians, so we weren't involved in any of those anyway. But even most Americans weren't involved in the Gulf War in the early 90s.
And we talked a lot about this when we did our American Beauty podcast, that a lot of movies were reflecting this ennui and this violent undercurrent of what happens to a whole generation that doesn't have anything real to fight for. And then you get movies like Fight Club, and you get things like grunge music.
Or movies like this that point out when things should be okay in every city in America. Not so much.
Mm. And they're far from okay. It's hardly as if the situation has
gotten
better.
And it is nice you've got the inner city in this movie, and then months later we've got a much wealthier city in California where things should be perfect, and yet still there are people doing chicky runs and switchblade fights. Young gay students who can't be young gay students. I'm talking about Sal Mineo in Rebel Without a Cause.
Mm-hmm. And teenagers are going to be teenagers. No matter where they live, they're always going to be troubled, and they're always going to be going through that awkward, terrible time in their lives that we all experience and yet somehow manage to forget when we become old enough to have teenage kids ourselves.
Mm. We've talked about the cast. It is very diverse for a film of this era. You even have some Asians, although they have no dialogue, but they are in that classroom. One anyway, I saw him in the background of many of the scenes, and then he's a part of the scene at the end, the big climax. And Gled Ford, who does play Daddy-O, he was in the business for 50 plus years. I guess his most famous title might be The Big Heat, noir film from 53, only a few years before this one. He was in the original 310 to Yuma, and then he was Superman's Earth Dad in Superman 1978. But he does flip-flop probably three different times, and when he cares, and when he's fed up. And then he cares, but he's fed up, but he cares.
Yeah. That's probably my biggest complaint about the movie.
That he's not consistent.
He's really inconsistent. And it just kind of goes back and forth one too many times.
If his young baby son had died, based on what these guys had done, or at least West had done to his wife, he would have gone absolutely psycho.
He would have turned the switchblade on them.
Yeah, West wouldn't be going to some reform school or jail or wherever it might be. He'd be going to the mortuary.
It'd be a whole different movie.
Tag on the toe, you know. Sidney Poitier, who does play, originally in the movie early on, a bad student, becomes a beloved teacher in To Sir With Love, and he won the Oscar for Lilies of the Field. We know about this guy's career. In the Heat of the Night, Guests Just Come to Dinner, both AFI movies. He's still alive, just doesn't make movies anymore, and he is one of the truly respected people in the business, I think. Kind of the Jackie Robinson of film. And I don't think that people, at least outwardly, seem to have a big problem with that. It's almost like, you know what, if we're going to ever let black guys into the film, yeah, that's the guy.
Well, they must have been writing parts for black guys in film. The parts didn't show up because he existed. The parts were getting written, and he was getting cast. And there probably just wasn't a lot of leading roles, so they just kept going to the same well, which was Poitier. And for good reason, he pops, for lack of a better word. He just has this incredible natural screen persona. He stole every scene he's in.
Well, Guests Who Come to Dinner, we talked about that movie on the Top 100 Project being something that wasn't a great film, but it had great things in it. It
also didn't age well at all.
But there are so many scenes of him or Spencer Tracy, and Katharine Hepburn as well, but especially him, I thought, more than the others, really, his more famous co-stars, where he goes from being nice and almost too nice, he's almost too perfect, like we said in that podcast, but with his father, at least, he gets fucking mad. Get off my back! You have to get off my back! The dialogue maybe wouldn't work if another actor spoke it, but they happened to get the right guy to play these characters who played somebody who hadn't been a leading man in Hollywood before, being a black guy, at least not consistently. Daddy-O's wife is Anne Francis. She was in the business for 55 plus years. What a long career. The same year as this, she was in Bad Day at Black Rock, and she was also in Forbidden Planet, which is a little more famous movie. That's based on the Tempest Shakespeare storyline, but a sci-fi movie, and a curious one. You maybe should check it out. Two other actors I want to mention. Richard Kiley, who plays the teacher, gets his records broken up and destroyed by West. Those assholes. Another guy who worked for about a half century. A lot of voiceover work, including in Jurassic Park. And if you've seen Jurassic Park enough times, you might recognize when the old man says, "We hired Richard Kiley. Spare no expense." I guess because of his famous voice, I suppose. And then Paul Mazursky plays one of the students, too. He later became a director of Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, the swinging movie in 1970, 69, one of those two. And then Harry and Tonto, and plenty of other titles, actually. But he was an actor back in 1955. This is a guy we've not said the whole podcast, at the director and writer, Richard Brooks. Very underrated guy who did a lot of interesting films, including in Cold Blood, which we watched about a year or two ago.
Love that movie.
Mm-hmm. And he won a writing Oscar for Elmer Gantry with Burt Lancaster in 1960. He directed for 35 years and wrote movies for more than 40 years. Good Western, The Professionals, long list of credits. We'll include a link on the website to him, of course, to look up what he's done. It's a lot of good stuff. The producer, Pandro Berman, or Pandro S. Berman, he was a producer on one of your favorites, Bev, from the Top 100 Project, Swing Time.
I knew you were going to say soon the way you looked at me. I knew it was going to be Swing Time. And they notoriously hated Swing Time.
He also did Father of the Bride. The movie is 1:75:1, so just a basic widescreen film. Black and white production, so another one of these. We've seen a few of these. All three 50s films we've covered in the Next 100 Project have been black and white films. Ten Commandments, Wages of Fear, Now This. And it was on TCM, which is why we watched it, because I saw it there and thought, I've not seen that movie in years. Let's record that. I thought I'd watch it by myself. We were maybe going to cover this movie in the summer-ish of this year. We moved it up till now. And, of course, you're now saying, why did we do that in the first place?
Did you just say that Ten Commandments was a black and white film?
Oh, it's in the 50s. That's right. It's not the third black and white film. So three 50s films and three black and white. The other black and white film is probably The Yankees, which we did just last week.
Okay.
You're right. Sorry. Okay. Thank you.
I didn't imagine it.
Fact checker is on the job. Good job, Bev. Russell Harlan, the cinematographer. Another long career, 33 years. He shot To Kill a Mockingbird in 1962, another black and white film. Rio Bravo, the 1951 version of The Thing, and a lot of westerns, so some classics on his resume. The editor, Ferris Webster, who often worked with John Frankenheimer, Manchurian Candidate, one of our favorites, was on the Top 100 Project. But he also did cut The Magnificent Seven and The Great Escape. One of those we're going to cover pretty soon, in fact. So, good editor there. Well, here you go. I was asking this question. What do you think of the editing of Blackboard Jungle?
Well, if I had been in the edit suite, I probably would have cut out some of the scenes where Dadier goes back and forth and back and forth. One of the things you do in the edit suite is you take a look at something and you say, just pacing-wise, plot-wise, this doesn't work. Some of those scenes probably should have been removed.
Yet this movie was nominated for Ferris Webster's editing. Ooh. Bev is now getting redder and madder by the second.
You know how enraged I get about Oscar nominations in the 50s?
How dare they? The music is uncredited for both Scott Bradley and Charles Wolcott. Wolcott worked with Disney a lot, Bradley in short films, but really, the movie's known for its jazzy soundtrack. Even though people are always going to think about Rock Around the Clock, let's talk about that right now. So, I'm going to jump ahead to what I usually cover a little later on, which is the AFI list. The only one it made was the Top 100 Songs with Rock Around the Clock. It was 50th on that list. Does that song suit this movie?
Well, it doesn't reflect, like you said, the soundtrack and the rest of the film, which is much jazzier, which in the 50s would have been a very subversive form of music, and rock and roll was too. I mean, it's hard to look back and hear that song and think of it as anything but quaint, because now it's just this notorious pop hit. As long as I've lived, I've never thought that song was rebellious or scandalous in any way, but in the 50s it was. In the 50s it sounded like something really fresh and brand new, but it's weird that it only plays at the very beginning and the very end, and you don't really hear another rock song throughout the movie. Mm-hmm. It was the first rock song to ever be in a film this way.
And that's one of the reasons why it's recognized by the AFI. And teenagers were dancing in the aisles to this song.
Yes! In the theaters, when they went to see it, they just got up and danced to it. They freaked out for it. It's part of why the movie was successful. And it made the song a massive hit. This song was not even a single. It was a B-side, and they found it because they were going through the record collection of Glenn Ford's teenage son, Peter. Mm-hmm. It was the first rock and roll song to ever hit number one on the Billboard charts. And stayed there for weeks. It was kind of like, you know, I mentioned grunge earlier, it would be the rock and roll equivalent of Smells Like Teen Spirit, of the really big breakout hit.
And it does suit American Graffiti because they are rocking around the clock. They're staying up all night to party and drive around in cars.
It's 1960 in American
62.
Graffiti? 62. 62, so it's much later when rock has completely taken over the culture already, whereas in Blackboard Jungle it would have been something much more brand new.
And I don't know if it really suits Happy Days either for what that show is about, but I just don't think it suits this movie.
It stands out as a little strange.
Despite the fact that AFI loved it and put it number 50 on their songs list.
Well, you have to connect the two, though, because it's part of why people remember Blackboard Jungle.
Yeah, and we've said before that score and song can be the counterplay more than anything else in a movie. You have to light people, so cinematography has to work in some kind of way with the movie you're making. You can overlight a horror film, which is unusual, and still make it scary. But you can go against the grain of everything else you have in a film with either the music score or a song or a series of songs in a movie and make it work against itself. Your biggest problem with music has always been that Spielberg, Lucas, those kinds of guys just have music tell you what you're supposed to feel.
Yeah.
Terry Gilliam said that in many interviews I've seen him do. Other people have criticized those guys for that too.
I don't like it when people use score as a crutch.
Right. But here's a song that doesn't play with the movie we're watching, but I'm just saying that I don't think that helps it, and I don't think it hurts it. It just seems like, why is this here? And then at the end, why is this here again?
Yeah, you really notice it more at the end when you've seen the whole film. It stands out because it doesn't match the rest of the score. Maybe you just had to be in 1955 to understand why that song worked and why it was making a statement about the time and place the film was living in. You could say that about Do the Right Thing and Fight the Power, and that song was a hit after that film came out, and it was perfectly appropriate for the time and place that it was there. Rap was hardly a new genre of music by the time Do the Right Thing came out, but it made a hit of that song. It made celebrities of Public Enemy. Although it was really perfect for that movie, so I guess that's a wrong point to make.
Also on the songs list, number 40 was Fight the Power. Okay, so we've covered most of the influence. You said Dangerous Minds, that's a key one, of course. Also Stand and Deliver. Edward James Olmos plays the inspirational school teacher. Lou Diamond Phillips has a role in that film, too.
There's lots of inspirational teachers. Yeah, you've got that. You've got the principal, Finding Forrester, Freedom Riders, and you even mentioned To Kill a Mockingbird. I'm not saying this film is the reason To Kill a Mockingbird is great, but it's more like maybe that film got greenlit because this genre had already opened up.
That's one of the reasons why movies that aren't necessarily that great can be important and AFI-able. We're way past that point, I suppose, saying a movie is worthy of that because the list is done now. But yes, if a movie's not perfect, but it opens the door for something else comes along that's even better, then that should be honored.
And it isn't a perfect movie by any sense, but it obviously hit a nerve and it was very popular. And sometimes that in itself can be influential because it helped catapult rock and roll into the dominant position that held in pop music for decades. I'm sure that was going to happen anyway, but this was the catalyst. And it proved there was a market for this kind of movie. It also helped prove there was a market for teen movies along with Rebel Without a Cause. It created that whole subgenre.
Mm-hmm. The other influence I have is A Clockwork Orange. Now, why are they connected? Because Blackboard Jungle apparently did what they suspected A Clockwork Orange might do, and Do the Right Thing for that matter. You mentioned that one. And that's lead to teenage violence in theaters. Mm-hmm. Teenagers were getting aggressive and even violent with each other when they saw this movie. Everyone was worried, well, Kubrick was, about it with A Clockwork Orange. Maybe hoodlum gangs will start up in England, and I don't want to be the one responsible for that. And then all the people out there in the media, well, a lot of them at least, said, Do the Right Thing would inspire black people to get up and start riots. That did not happen. But this film actually did do that.
I also thought of Clockwork Orange, but for a totally different reason, because like I said, it's really strange that all these kids attend class, and I thought about Clockwork Orange as the only film I've ever seen that features a truant officer, and this truant officer is so dedicated to his job that he, like, grabs Alex in the nuts and hurts him to punish him for, you know, making him look bad or just not going to school, I suppose.
It's a pretty important character in that movie.
Yeah, he is, and so I thought all these kids must have truant officers just as devoted as that truant officer in Clockwork Orange.
So West wanted to be off doing something else, but the truant officer
he was too afraid
on the straight and narrow. But then he said, I need another job that doesn't pay anything but just to fuck with my teacher. Let me spend all day drawing up blueprints on how I can fuck with him.
How can I be the biggest sadist? Yes. In my class,
I don't want to have fun doing cool things. Let's just think about messing with my teacher. Okay, the awards and list section is not very long, but here we go. 4 Oscar nominations for Richard Brooks' adapted screenplay, the editing, which you didn't like that much, the cinematography by Russell Harlan, and the art direction, the sets. Rock Around the Clock was, of course, on the Top 100 Songs list, and it was nominated for these three lists it did not make. The Top 100 Thrills, which is mostly about the last confrontation. Top 100 Cheers, some inspirational. Okay, I'll give you that one as a nominee. And then Daddy-O as a Top 50 Hero nominee. But he's so inconsistent, is he really worthy of that? All right, Bev, well, I chose this one in a way, and then TCM encouraged us to choose it even sooner. You already said you didn't like it that much, but wrap up your last thoughts about Blackmore Jungle, a movie that has not been in the public consciousness for very long, but then TCM is still showing it. It must matter to people in some kind of way.
Yeah, I guess it's just the fact that all popular, influential movies don't necessarily age well, or weren't even that good to begin with. It's not without its charms, but it would be pretty hard to recommend to anyone except maybe a diehard Sidney Poitier fan who, for some reason, hadn't seen it yet.
A completist, yeah. I think I'm in line with the Rotten Tomatoes people, 77 and 76%. I would say I'm right around there, 70% for whatever that's worth exactly. So a mild thumbs up, if you will, a Roger Ebert reference there.
It's pretty generous, if you ask me.
I guess you're a lot lower than 77, 76%.
Yes.
Okay, we'll move on from this one to get to something entirely different and a lot more modern, because when the next 100 Project reconvenes in a week, we'll have a revered work from the Coen brothers. No zany comedy, though. It'll be the 2007 Oscar-winning modern western, No Country for Old Men.
I have a big grin right now because I am so thrilled about this one.
We've been in the past for a while now on the Next 100 Project, so now we get very recent. And our second 2007 film since the beginning of the year, There Will Be Blood, was the first one. So the becoming attraction trivia for No Country for Old Men. How many times have the Coen brothers written screenplays that they did not direct? Now, of course, they directed this one and wrote it and produced it and everything. They always do. But I thought it was a curious thing because they've written a few recently. But how many in total?
I can only think of one off the top of my head. That's
more than one. I'll tell you that right now.
Okay.
More than one.
All right, so for the answer to that, please tune in to next week's podcast for No Country for Old Men. In the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. There you can find our roster of all the films we've covered that include all 123 films that ever made the AFI's two Top 100 Hollywood Films of All Time list. And while you're there, please rate us and review us. It helps other people find us. We also love to hear from you. You can reach us on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can message us privately, which is probably a more reliable way to get through to us, honestly, so we're not very good tweeters. But our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. We really love to hear from you guys. Before we go, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, sparkplugcoffee.com.
See ya, daddy-o.
And cut. Screws out.
Oh, Eva!